The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Great to be back broadcasting in our beautiful studio here at Edstone. Wonderful sunshiny weekend, as you might be able to see from my face. Quite a lot of time out of doors yesterday and even on Saturday. So it's good to get some vitamin D. We need that to burn off all of those bad bacteria, all the germs, all of the viruses. Over the weekend, we had a new program here in the UK. It's also at our website, Wilderness Years, and that brought in 167 requests. I forget what we advertised on that program, but in any event, some pretty good numbers. And we have had quite a few repeats play in the UK over the last several weeks. So this was one of the first new ones we've had in a while. Good to see that response. And also, I'll just briefly mention, we got some feedback from one of our listeners who, he said that his wife, she goes on a daily walk and came into contact with a young man, a neighbor that she sees quite often, who expressed his frustration with the news coverage and what's happening in the world, all this craziness. And so so she told the young man about the Trumpet Daily program, and then just left it at that. She didn't bring it up anymore after that, and decided she wouldn't unless he brought it up. And so a couple weeks went by, and she passed this neighbor again, and he told her that he's been listening to the radio program every day since, and he loves it. So it's great to see the listening audience increase, as you've seen even yourself in watching the YouTube stream and listening to the audio stream. The numbers do continue to move upward. Well, yesterday, worldwide, we had the fewest deaths, I think, since March 29th, so almost a month, 3,751 COVID-19-related deaths, we should stress. The numbers for the United States, also the fewest since March 31st, so almost a month there, and the same with the UK. It was at its lowest since March 31st, so about 4 weeks. The curve has definitely flattened here in the UK. The NHS has not been overwhelmed. There are plenty of hospital beds in the ICU units, and there's plenty of ventilators worldwide. The United States is even offering ventilators to second and third world nations that might need some. So some good signs for sure. Even, I'll talk about the U.S. here in just a second. But the Prime Minister here in the U.K., he's back at 10 Downing Street. He moved back there yesterday, I think it was, after being off for a few weeks. He got a really bad case of coronavirus. So a lot of people were pretty hopeful that he'd come back. He's back in health and would relax some of the lockdown restrictions. But he really didn't do that this morning. He had a speech about 9 a.m. this morning, UK time, and he said it was too much of a risk to relax the lockdown just yet. He did say that we've won phase one of this battle, this conflict, but we have to gear up for phase two. And so now that's in a lot of the discussion, particularly with those that talked about the models will do this or millions will die here if we don't do this. Now you're hearing a lot of talk about a second wave. In fact, Neil Ferguson, you'll remember him. He's the one that came up with the imperial model that said that 2.2 million Americans would die. And that, 500, 600,000 people in Britain would die from coronavirus if we didn't do something to stop it. Now, he's saying, and this is according to the Times, there could be 100,000 deaths in the UK by the end of the year should the present lockdown be replaced with only shielding policies. So you remove the lockdown, I guess he's hoping it goes on for a year. This scientist a total lockdown of the United Kingdom. If you lift it, he says, you would think this man would have been thoroughly run out of town by now. But no, he's still, this article says he's still advising the government. He's still advising Boris Johnson's government. It says Matt Hancock, the health secretary, said last week that cases needed to drop substantially before the next phase could be truly effective. So we've still got to wait it out. You can see Matt Hancock, Neil Ferguson, these are the ones that are running the show. How much longer will the medical lobby, as Mr. Armstrong termed it in the Plain Truth About Healing, how much longer will the medical experts be calling the shots here? This is a tweet from journalist Toby Young. He said, disappointing speech from Prime Minister Johnson this morning. UK now an extreme outlier in not having announced an exit strategy. They're doing it all across Europe. They've got an exit strategy. They're talking about it. They're announcing it all across Europe, but not here in the UK. He said evidence NHS would be overwhelmed if some social distancing measures were relaxed is negligible. Evidence lockdown is harmful to public health and the economy is overwhelming. It's overwhelming that the lockdown is harming us. And yet it continues. It continues here in the UK. In the United States, it's a little bit different. Some states are beginning to return to normal. Of course, some are moving at a faster pace than others. But to see some relatively positive headlines, even at the Drudge Report, that's a website that's been scaremongering from day one, from the beginning. But now even at Drudge, back to life, lockdowns ease, it said earlier today. Meanwhile, at the New York Times, they're not one to let any story go that makes the president look bad. Still, they're talking about the injection, drinking Clorox, drinking bleach. That was from, what, last Thursday? It's front page news at the New York Times still. This is Monday morning. Front page news. Trump's disinfectant remark raises a question about the very stable genius. And reading through this, oh, brother. Just one snide remark after another. The contempt that this author has for the president. It says here, Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, a Republican who has been willing to speak skeptically about Mr. Trump's virus leadership. Of course, they go and they always want to go and find that Republican, and there's usually a few of them that's going to be critical of this administration. He said on ABC's This Week, that would be yesterday, that it does send a wrong message when misinformation spreads from a public official. How about that? Misinformation coming from a public official, as if it's only coming from a president of the United States. There has been misinformation, disinformation, propaganda throughout this whole story, and it's coming from every direction, the media in particular. This article says no modern American politician can match Mr. Trump's record of false or illogical statements, which has invited questions about his intelligence. That's the front page of the New York Times. It's not even in the opinion section. That's the front page. President Trump's an idiot. And, you know, now this latest episode, you really have to call into question his intelligence. Listen to what Molly Hemingway had to say about this this scandal that's not even a scandal at all. She's talking about, again, those comments from last Thursday. Here's what she said yesterday, clip one.
I don't think it's particularly helpful for the president to be speculating about treatment. I don't think it was necessary. At the same time, the media response to it was really contemptuous of the American people. This idea that people don't understand how to talk about speculative treatment. I mean, you can talk about radiation killing cancer without people sticking their heads in microwaves. And the way the media took this, as if everybody was about to, you know, drink bottles of Clorox, was really, it showed a sort of a form of hatred for the American people, I think.
An excellent comment there, because really that's what it's aimed at. The contempt that the East Coast media has for the American people. You've got the New York Times leads the way. You see the article I just referenced. The president's an idiot. All of his supporters are idiots. And as soon as he says this or that, of course they're going to go and drink Clorox. That's the New York Times, the paper of record. And you have in the same paper, by the way, over the weekend, nervous Republicans see Trump sinking and taking Senate with him. That's the New York Times revealing really the goal of this corona panic, this pandemonium. They can't let it go. All of their eggs are in this basket now. This is their one chance at victory in November. So they're searching. They're searching for any Republican they can find to confirm that they're worried. They're worried they're going to lose. They're worried that this is sinking the entire party. Well, I guess we'll see about that in a few months. This Jerusalem Post article talking about, it's actually about Jerusalem or Israel's population. It is growing. It's at 9.2 million now. By 2030, it's supposed to be up to 11 million. But there's some interesting little facts in this article about population growth that discuss COVID-19 and its impact on the population growth, or lack thereof. It says here, remember, every year, more than 45,000 people die in Israel. So you've got the yearly figures. We've given them to you before. In the U.S., well, now it escapes me. Is it 2 million or 3 million a year, I think, that died, the mortality just in total? Well, it's 600,000 here in the U.K., I know that. And then the little state of Israel, 45,000, they die every year, about 17,000 from heart disease and cancer. 17,000 from heart disease and cancer. So coronavirus is not, this article says, on its current trajectory, going to change any of the assumptions used to shape those projections. This is according to this guy that put out the report on the population growth. So it's not going to change anything. There are people dying in Israel. I forget the last count. It's incredibly low. I think 113 or 14 or 15. But there's some corona-related deaths in Israel. But as this author of this study says, it's not going to impact the overall death rate. Now, listen to this paragraph. What we know so far is that the average age of death, this is in Israel, is 82. And most of those people have had other serious health conditions. So it's important. It's more an important test for the healthcare system and for the political class than a demographically significant event in the population. It says that will be the case even if deaths head into the thousands. Even if they head into the thousands, it's not going to affect the overall rate of death in Israel. But notice how it points out that the average age is 82 and they have underlying health conditions. Some of them probably been smoking for 20 or 30 years. Some have had heart disease. Some are diabetic. That's in Israel. It's a Western diet there, and it's very much the same story in the United States. This supposed to be the worst pandemic since the Spanish flu, and yet is it having that big of an impact on the overall death rates? That's why those figures will be the ones to watch in the weeks ahead. Those weeks, week-by-week data, I think I gave it to you last maybe a week and a half ago. These past few weeks, the numbers have increased, but still, I think the highest week thus far has been 60,000 Americans that have died, and that goes back to 2 or 3 weeks ago. So the data's continually coming in, and we'll see a lot more a few weeks from now. But we certainly see a lot right now that we didn't see 6 or 8 weeks ago. We have data that we can actually plug in and look at and view. The overall death rate, Israel, the UK, the United States, will it even go up that much because of this virus, because of this sickness? Or if it does go up even slightly, does it justify killing the economy, destroying thousands of businesses, including even hospitals? Does it justify disrupting the lives or the livelihood of hundreds of millions of people? And in some cases, mayors and governors are using this as an excuse to open up the prisons, to let prisoners out. Because, well, we can't have COVID-19 spreading in a prison. This is what Nancy Pelosi had to say yesterday, by the way. I've played before this comment by Mayor de Blasio. These criminals let out in New York and they returned to their criminal activity. And he was just shocked that they would get out of jail and go right back to their same practices that got them into jail in the first place. Nancy Pelosi was asked about releasing these prisoners. And here's how she responded yesterday, clip two.
In our caucus, we are very devoted to the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was homeless, you sheltered me. When I was in prison, you visited me. And so this for us is a part of our value system.
Okay, first of all, when I was in prison, you visited me. That's a fair bit different than you let me out of prison. And furthermore, the passage, you can look at this in Matthew 25. The part that she leaves out, it says, this is Jesus speaking, I was sick and you visited me. Now that violates some serious social distancing regulations. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison, it says there, and you came unto me. It's a great passage, by the way. We should put together a Bible study segment on that. But here is the Speaker of the House. She thinks she's quoting from the Bible, just mangling the text to justify her social utopia, her socialist utopia. That's what it amounts to, using the Bible as support for her policies. There was this story, by the way, she comes from San Francisco. There was a story out of Central California in Bakersfield from, the middle of last week, and really an astounding revelation coming from these two doctors, and it just kind of trickled into conservative media. I suppose it got some coverage locally out in Bakersfield, but this is the kind of story, really, that instead of writing about how dumb the president is, if the New York Times would put a little bit of work into actually going to the front lines, looking at the number of beds, looking at the number of ventilators, and actually talking to some of the doctors themselves. I suppose they do some of that, but it's always in an attempt to find the one that you want, that will say what you want to say. Well, here were these two doctors, Dr. Dan Erickson and Artin Masihi. They had a message that basically was, look, the hospitals are not overwhelmed. In fact, we're laying off staff. We've got plenty of space. We have plenty of hospital beds. And furthermore, this type of social distancing, it doesn't help us individually. In fact, it's weakening our immune system, and it's setting us up for more disease in the future because of it. They say that it doesn't justify this full lockdown. I don't know where the press conference took place, but it was local media only. And then these two doctors there, most of the talking here was done by Dr. Erickson. But here's what he has to say about the workload for hospitals in California. And keep in mind, California was the first to lock the entire state down, 39.5 million. And a little over 1,000 deaths, I think it was, last time I checked. Here's what Dr. Erickson had to say, clip three.
Our volumes have dropped significantly. The hospitals, their ICUs are empty, essentially, and they're shutting down floors, they're furloughing patients, they're furloughing doctors. So the health system has been evacuated in certain places. In New York, the health system is working at maximum capacity. In California, we're really at a minimal capacity.
Minimal capacity in California. 1,720 total deaths in a state of 39.5 million. And its governor, Governor Newsom, the mayor of Los Angeles, some of the strictest lockdown measures in the whole country. There is a, you probably saw the footage, this skateboard facility on a beach somewhere in Malibu or wherever. These bulldozers that came in and poured sand all over the skateboard park because they didn't want the skaters in there. And then the dirt bike guys showed up, which was kind of funny. But these are some of the extreme measures that they're taking. Do not go outside. Do not go to the beach. Do not get sun. Do not get vitamin D from the sun. Never mind the data that we're now seeing. We've got to do everything like Queens. We've got to do everything like New York City. Brett Stevens at the New York Times. He said, consider a thought experiment in which metropolitan New York weren't just its own state, but its own country. What would the crisis for what remained of America look like? In other words, if you take New York City out of the equation, what does the crisis look like for America? It says, in this slightly smaller nation of a little more than 300 million people, the death toll would amount to about 7.5 per 100,000, slightly above Germany's levels. So Germany has one of the lowest levels. And as it happens, they were probably better equipped than just about any other European nation for this crisis because they had so many more beds, so many more ICU units than Northern Italy, for example. I think something like three or four times as many. So, and they've done a fair bit of testing in Germany as well. But you can't just take a one-size-fits-all plan. And that's what we were sold this from the beginning. Northern Italy is coming to you. Queens is coming to South Dakota. Queens is coming to Wyoming. Well, if you compare the hospitals in California to Queens, and really there's even availability, and they sent the USS Comfort away. They don't need it. The beds at the Javits Center in New York City, empty. So even New York City has space, and they've been hit the hardest. Listen to Dr. Erickson in his press conference from last week. I think this is from April 22nd, clip 4.
And so one of the things I'd like to talk about is when I talk to ER physicians around the country, what's happening? Well, because COVID has become the focus, people with heart disease, people with cancer, hypertension, and various things that are critical are choosing not to come in based on fear.
Okay, so this is a point and that's coming out here in the UK as well. All the cancer screenings that aren't happening because they had to clear out the hospitals, remember, for the onslaught that was coming, the onslaught that never came, as it turns out. And so now how many sicknesses, again, this is the world system, totally dependent on Western medicine. How much worse will it be later this year or next year as far as cancer and heart disease and all these things are concerned? And all because of fear. Potential patients or just patients not deciding to come in because they're afraid. They're afraid to go to the hospital. Why? Well, who whipped this up? Why are they scared? Why is the general public scared? This is from Spiked Online here in the UK. It says COVID-19 has brought the conformism, apocalypticism, and self-importance of the media to the fore. It says the news media in the UK and worldwide has rarely seemed more important or influential than during the coronavirus crisis. Web searches for news have hit record highs, with COVID-19 dominating more than any issue on record. It says the British government lists journalists as key workers. Media sources praise them as the unsung heroes of the crisis. The journalists, if you can believe it. The ones that have whipped up this frenzy of pandemonium of panic. They're seen as the unsung heroes. Same with the hospital officials, the hospital workers. They can do no wrong. And then you have these two men that have devoted their lives, these two doctors, to the study of viruses and diseases, and they're actually working in emergency rooms, and they're just ignored. Well, we can't listen to them because they're not saying what we want. It says here, when a senior war correspondent from a top British newspaper can write that in Corona hit London, quote, popping out to buy milk might prove as deadly as driving on Kabul's most suicide bombed road. What does that do for the general public? Wow, you mean it's like Afghanistan? You mean it's like going out on a road where there's suicide bombs everywhere? That's what the media have been saying, and they're still saying it. Don't go outside. Don't go to the beach. Don't go to the park. Don't you know how this travels? This virus? It says, from the start, too much of the media has seized one-sidedly on the most unrestrained and unrealistic estimated death tolls. Morbid daily reports have casually mixed up the numbers dying from and with coronavirus. See, it's all the same in the media. As far as the media look at it, it's all the same. If you have a touch of coronavirus and yet you've been smoking and your lungs gave out because of it, well, then it's a corona death. It's like that joke online with the skydiver who forgot to take his parachute, died of coronavirus, wouldn't you know? It says news reports have singled out the atypical deaths of a few younger people with no known health problems, downplaying the fact that those dying with the COVID-19 are overwhelmingly elderly and infirmed. It says the result of apocalypse news has been to further inflame public anxieties. Further on, it says something must be done, journalism quickly helped to push the UK government into changing tack and imposing a general lockdown with far-reaching consequences for society. It will also make it hard for the authorities to relax the lockdown anytime soon, faced with a chorus of media disapproval. See, this is what Boris Johnson's going up against. Same thing with President Trump. Now, some governors, to their credit, like the Oklahoma governor, the governor in Georgia, the governor in Florida, Colorado even, with a Democrat governor, they're beginning to lift some of these restrictions, in large part because their populations are demanding it. But the leader here in the UK, President Trump, they're going up against a media that do not want this lockdown lifted anytime soon. You must panic. Remember Peggy Noonan from March 12th, I think it was. Don't panic is terrible advice. Listen to Dr. Erickson from last week, clip 5.
Typically, you quarantine the sick. When someone has measles, you quarantine them. We've never seen where we quarantine the healthy, where you take those without disease and without symptoms and lock them in your home.
We've never seen it. We've never, ever seen it. Hey, that sounds like something you might have heard on this program a week or two ago. We're quarantining the healthy. It should be the sick. That's the way it is in the Bible. Even the other doctor, Dr. Masihi, he brought up the Bible in this press conference. This is an emergency room doctor. Listen to what he said in that same press conference, clip 14.
But historically, if you look at biblical times, you look at leprosy, Mycobacterium leprae, which is the bacteria that causes it. They isolated the sick. They didn't isolate everybody else. So isolating the healthy just doesn't make sense, in our opinion.
It doesn't make sense. It's not biblical at all. If it's biblically, have you noticed this? If it's based on the Bible, it works. If it's based on human reasoning, it breaks down in a hurry. Look at how many things this is breaking down around the world. I told you on Friday or Thursday last week, the problem with starvation all these other nations following the lead of Western nations, a total lockdown, like in India, like in African nations, Venezuela, locked down, and now the problems of starvation, or here in the United States, of what? Spousal abuse, child molestation, alcoholism, depression, suicide. You've heard it before. Whenever you get away from the Bible, though, and rely on these scientific models, well, they talked a little bit about how the models were wrong, catastrophically so. Clip six.
No, the initial models were woefully inaccurate. They predicted millions of cases of death, not of prevalence or incidence, but death. That is not materializing. What is materializing in the state of California is 12% positives. Well, if we have 39.5 million people, if we just take a basic calculation and extrapolate that out, that equates to about 4.7 million cases throughout the state of California, which means this thing is widespread. That's the good news. We've seen 1,227 deaths in the state of California with a possible incidence or prevalence of 4.7 million. That means you have a 0.03 chance of dying from COVID-19 in the state of California. 0.03 chance of dying from COVID in the state of California. Does that necessitate sheltering in place? Does that necessitate shutting down medical systems? Does that necessitate people being out of work?
0.03% chance of dying in California. Now, I would think most people are probably pretty comfortable with that kind of risk. Comfortable enough to carry on with your daily life, I mean. The whole state, though, keep in mind, 0.03% chance of death. Now, as these two doctors bring out, they're sympathetic to what happened 6-8 weeks ago, because they said 6-8 weeks ago, we didn't know any of this. We didn't know how contagious it was. We now know it is contagious, very much so. And we now know that the mortality rate is significantly, many times lower than what was said in early March. And we also know, I read to you the article from Israel, that most of the people dying are in elderly care facilities. The average age, 82 in Israel. An 82-year-old with an underlying condition. So these two doctors are saying, now that we know this, how can we continue with these kinds of draconian measures, particularly when they're causing so many other troubles, so many other problems? It's a recipe for disaster. They're saying, look, our immune systems are going to get weakened, and then our hospitals, because they're laying off people, they're not going to be equipped and ready if there is another wave of this fall or whenever. At the Wall Street Journal, they talk about Sweden taking the other approach. They've just tried to look after their elderly care centers to pretty much lock those facilities down. But the rest of Swedish society, schools, cafes, and so on, it's been left open. It says here, how did the Swedes do? They suffered 80 deaths per million 21 days after crossing the 1 per million threshold level. It says, with 10 million people, Sweden's death rate without a shutdown and massive unemployment is lower than that of the 7 hardest hit U.S. states: Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Louisiana, Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, and New York. All of which, except Louisiana, shut down in 3 days or less. It says, despite stories about high death rates, Sweden's is in the middle of the pack in Europe, comparable to France, better than Italy, Spain, and the UK, and worse than Finland, Denmark, and Norway. It says older people in care homes accounted for half of Sweden's deaths. And then it says, finally, And this is a good point to make as well, because you have liberals on TV just kind of sneering at anyone that would bring up Sweden. Oh, here you go with Sweden again. It used to be that you hated Sweden because it was socialist. But it says here, we should cheer for Sweden to succeed, not ghoulishly bash them. They may prove that many aspects of the U.S. shutdown were mistakes, ineffective, but economically devastating, and point the way to correcting them. Why not look to Sweden and say, well, hey, let's learn something from Sweden. After all, the data is now coming in. We now know a lot more than we did 6 weeks ago. Listen again to Dr. Erickson from last week, clip 7.
It's similar to the flu. If you study the numbers in 2017 and 2018, we had 50 to 60 million with the flu. And we had a similar death rate. In the deaths in the United States were 43,545, similar to the flu of 2017-2018. We always have between 37 and 60,000 deaths in the United States every single year. No pandemic talk, no shelter in place, no shutting down of businesses, no sending doctors home. And we don't necessarily report all of our flu tests. We do thousands of flu tests every year. We don't report everyone because the flu is ubiquitous. And to that note, we have a flu vaccine. How many people even get the flu vaccine? The flu's dangerous. It kills people. So just because you have a vaccine doesn't mean it's going to be everywhere. And it doesn't mean everyone's going to take it, because we see every year that we have a vaccine and I would say probably 50% of the public doesn't even want it. So just because you have a vaccine, unless you force it on the public, doesn't mean they're going to take it.
Unless you force it on the public. And that's really where Big Pharma's headed. That's what Fauci and Birx want. They want mandatory vaccines. You think it'll never happen? Just like 2 months ago, you probably thought a full lockdown would never happen. But he points out that, look, this is similar to the flu. Now, all through this crisis, that has been heresy. You are shouted down for making that comparison. You are shouted down for pointing to statistics from 2017 and 18. But look, the data is in. It's coming in. And you hear of one study after another after another. The new antibody evidence. That's from the Wall Street Journal today. And it cites studies in New York, San Francisco, Chicago. These two doctors, by the way, and this reminded me of some of the points we made on the program a week and a half ago, the Sabbath program about physical health and taking care of your immune system. We can skip ahead to clip 9 here, see what Dr. Erickson had to say about the development of the immune system in a human being. Clip 9.
The immune system is built by exposure to antigens, viruses, bacteria. When you're a little child crawling on the ground, putting stuff in your mouth, viruses and bacteria come in, you form an antigen-antibody complex, you form IgG, IgM. This is how your immune system is built. You don't take a small child, put them in bubble wrap in a room and say, go have a healthy immune system. This is immunology, microbiology 101. This is not something, this is the basis of what we've known for years.
Basics 101. Imagine if we had this mentality, what we see all over the world today, just washing your hands every 2 seconds. And by the way, going back to what Jesus said there about visiting the sick, it's not like he was going against quarantine laws there. But there are some exceptions. Certainly a minister anointing someone who's sick, there's some contact there, even physically. But you'll recall in the Gospels, I forget chapter and verse, but the Pharisees that came and criticized Jesus because his disciples ate bread, they broke bread before they washed their hands. They didn't go and wash their hands like these self-righteous Pharisees did. There's a balance here. And a lot of it gets back to what this doctor is saying. You don't have a baby and then just immediately put it in a bubble. And think about the things that go into a baby's mouth. Sometimes it's frightening to see what they immediately want to put into their mouths. Well, you grow up and you develop immunity. There's good bacteria and there's bad bacteria. He went on to explain, clip 10.
When you take human beings and you say, go into your house, clean all your counters, Lysol them down, you're going to kill 99% of viruses and bacteria. Wear a mask, don't go outside. What does that do to our immune system? Our immune system is used to touching. We share bacteria, staphylococcal, streptococcal bacteria, viruses. We develop an immune response daily to this stuff. When you take that away from me, my immune system drops. As I shelter in place, my immune system drops. You keep me there for months, it drops more. And now I'm at home, hand washing vigorously, washing the counters, worried about things that are indeed what I need to survive. Let's follow the science. This is immunology, folks. This is microbiology. This is what we've combined together. We have 40 years of experience in this. This is common sense immunology.
Common sense immunology. I think the world could do with a little more of that right about now. It's not that quarantine doesn't apply. You heard the other doctors speak up for that. If you've got the measles, then yeah, put them in quarantine. The rest of us, though, carry on with our day-by-day living. And we don't have to go on through society cowering in fear about what germ we might touch or inhale. 101, so much of it is common sense. Again, I read this last week. Herbert Armstrong says the very first trouble with our deteriorating physical status is that we take sickness for granted. We seem to assume sickness is natural and necessary. A cold or a fever, see, we want to think that we catch that, that that came and attacked us from nowhere, and we didn't deserve it. We're innocent. In fact, we're guilty. He said a cold or fever is merely a sudden, violent elimination of toxins and poisons you have injected into your body by wrong diet, which has broken God's physical laws. So the idea here is that we want to build and strengthen our physical bodies and arrive at that, as he said in another article, that normal condition of robust, invigorating, radiant good health. It's possible. It's not easy in today's society, but it is possible when you're striving to obey God's physical health laws. Your immune system will be greatly strengthened. When we come back, we'll finish off our study from the wilderness years preparation that we got into on Friday's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email us, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Can you imagine a world without famine, disease, and pestilence? A world free of crime, war, and hatred? Man has tried throughout history to rid the world of these problems, but to no avail. Will man ever find the way to peace? The Bible speaks of a soon coming utopia, in which God will finally bring us peace. It will be a world governed by God's law of love. Poverty, famine, illiteracy, and escalating violence will be reversed. The dry and barren lands of the world will be made fertile, and resources will be plenteous. Sickness and disease will be replaced by robust and prosperous living. The language barrier will be bridged, and an education in the true values of life will flourish the world over. Beyond this bleak, unhappy, present-day reality is this soon-coming future. Our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, is free at our website, thetrumpet.com. Download it or request it free today.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
We talked on Friday about how that the wilderness years, those years in the 1930s, when Churchill was a political outcast, he was hard at work particularly on his biography about his famous ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough. And Henry Steele Commager said that this was really, really critical in preparing Churchill for the darkest hour of the 1940s. These were the most fertile years of his career, the 1930s, the wilderness years. This is when he transformed. One historian says that Churchill transformed from a politician to a statesman. He was ready to lead Britain right through its darkest hour. Well, I mentioned on Friday, you have Moses. You have examples in the Bible, these individuals that were prepared in the wilderness. The Israelites, as I mentioned on Friday, they learned some lessons. And of course, they had some lessons that they didn't learn while in the wilderness. Listen to these verses. This is Isaiah 40, verses 1 and 2. It says, comfort you, my people, says your God. Speak you comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received of the Eternal's hand double for all her sins. So it's a comforting message. It revolves around the return of Christ, but there's also some correction ahead of that return. Verse 3 says, the voice of him crying in the wilderness, prepare you the way of the Eternal, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. So John the Baptist, he fulfilled that role before Christ's first coming, but your Bible, the Gospels, tell us that there was another one, another individual, who would prepare the way for Christ's return in these last days. Herbert Armstrong came as that voice crying out in the wilderness. And you can certainly look at Mr. Armstrong's life. You can read through the autobiography and see, of course, that wilderness message. That's talking more about, as he explained in one of his coworker letters, a spiritual wilderness. He was crying out, but very few people listened. Now, he did have a message that went right around the world, and he did have millions of followers. The Plain Truth Circulation, the World Tomorrow broadcast bear this out. But he was, in so many ways, crying out in a wilderness. Most people didn't listen. Most of them didn't repent. And yet he was preparing. He was productive. He was preparing for the return of Christ. And you could even look at the early years of his ministry and see that he had some time in the wilderness himself, literally, where he was just pretty much alone, having to walk from place to place in the Willamette Valley when he had the public Bible lectures or whatever it was. Just a few people, a handful of people, listening to and heeding those messages back in the 1930s. Well, this prophecy here, verse 4 says, every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight and the rough places plain. Speaking of course, the wonderful world of tomorrow. So we've got to see in our years of preparation, even if no one listens, even if we're somewhat of an outcast, we've got to see where this is leading. We've got to make the most of those wilderness years preparation. Get busy writing that biography, so to speak, so that you're ready, so that we're all ready for the dark hours that are coming upon this world. A few lessons that I'll just leave you with. These were brought out in the TV program, the video that we produced for here in the UK over the weekend. You can look at Deuteronomy 8 or begin to turn there. But one lesson here is to remember humility, regarding Churchill in those critical years in the 1930s. My father wrote this back in 1998. He said, when Churchill got kicked out of office, he was depressed. He said that was the worst time of his life. He felt he was ruined forever. His wife was wondering if he was going to get through it. It says Winston Churchill was disgraced, but God was using that to humble him. He was using it to humble him. He wasn't a humble man. So we all have to be humbled. 1 Corinthians 1 says God calls the nobodies. We can't ever forget that. Now, at the same time, Mr. Armstrong said God hasn't called us to stay there because we're the kings and priests of tomorrow. We've got to prepare for those royal positions. But the point of it is, who are we? What are we without God, without God's truth? Somebody watched that sugar documentary that I mentioned. I think I mentioned it on the program a few programs ago. These little two-year-olds in New Zealand having their teeth pulled out because they're basically drinking soda pop from their bottle, their little toddler bottle. And this parent told me yesterday, it's just such a blessing to have God's truth, to know about the spiritual laws and the physical laws, things that we just wouldn't imagine ever doing because we've been exposed to the truth. And we know what those things would do to a little two-year-old, to their teeth and everything on the inside as well. Remember humility. This passage in Deuteronomy 8, it says that God is talking about when God took them into the wilderness to feed them and to provide for them and also to humble them. God led the Israelites into the wilderness so that they would humbly look to him. That's a valuable lesson to take away from any wilderness years that we might have. And also, the Israelites had to learn to walk by faith as well. That's another lesson, to follow the pillar cloud, to look to Christ. Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, we have to look unto Christ, as it says there, the author and the finisher of our salvation. Jesus said, I can of mine own self do nothing. John 5 and verse 30, as I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father which has sent me. I'm just trying to carry out the Father's will here. I'm trying to follow in the Father's steps. He did that, Christ did. Lastly, a final lesson, and again, you can see this from that Churchill example, is use those wilderness moments to thoroughly prepare for opportunities. And in truth, the opportunities are already there for all of us. This is like my father brings out in the Jude booklet. There are sobering times that we're in right now, but these are also days of opportunity. Henry Steele Commager, he said, surely this historical investigation, which for 5 years absorbed Churchill's energies, may be looked upon as a providential preparation for the years ahead when he was to stand a greater Marlborough, surveying a greater scene, presiding over a greater battle, commanding a greater coalition, whose destinies were fraught with greater significance. Read about Ezekiel 33. Read that prophecy. See where this work is headed. Have that vision and let it motivate you to prepare yourself for greatness, to prepare yourself for an opportunity. Diana Cooper said about Churchill, people talk about how brave Winston was in 1940, but his highest courage, and it was his moral courage, shone through when he saw war coming. England, virtually helpless, and himself impotent. He really didn't have much power. He couldn't do much except sound the alarm. She's saying that, look, I think he had more courage in the 1930s than he did in the 40s when he finally got the power to do something. Because in the 1930s, he was going against the grain. He was fighting against the establishment. He was striving to get the message out even when no one wanted to listen. That's when we can really develop those character traits of courage and determination, resourcefulness, perseverance, never give up. We're right here, as my father says in the New Throne of David book, we're here in the transition period. We're coming right close to the birth. God's going to spring his family on this world. Suddenly, at an instant, Isaiah 66, verses 8 and 9 bring this out. I don't have time to go there. But read those verses and read about that transition movement on page 34 of the New Throne of David book, as I say. I'd go through that myself, but we are out of time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.